Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday. That means time for the Week in Review. And we'll start with the rough week for Boston media outlets who found themselves making headlines this week, and not for good reasons. There's the ongoing delivery travails at the Boston Globe.
I miss my ritual. I go out front every morning to see if it's there. My neighbor's New York Times is there, but my Globe isn't.
And over in the glossies, Boston Magazine cut top staff amid restructuring. And on television, NBC announced that it's cutting ties with longtime affiliate WHDH Channel 7.
We're in a very different world where video or television, whatever you want to call it, is coming in so many different directions, and much of it is coming over the internet.
Joining us now to discuss is Tom Keen, former Boston City Councilor. Tom, great to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us today, Shira Springer, paper girl, no, just kidding, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Shira, good to have you with us as well.
Good to be here.
Okay, I have to say, like, the one media type of media we didn't mention was radio, so I'm going to tread a little lightly here. We're fine for now. But Shira, let's start with you. What has the mood been like at the Globe since this giant delivery fiasco started and kind of keeps on going?
I think the one word that describes it is frustration. Frustration that it happened in the first place. Frustration that the powers that be didn't know the extent of the problem when it first started. Frustration that initial estimates were going to be 4 to 6 months to fix this, that there wasn't a quicker fix. Frustration that we're still getting calls of very irate subscribers who haven't seen a Globe in almost a week and a half, perhaps longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think frustration. And then there's also underlying that a bit of can-do spirit emerging at the Globe. People, particularly reporters and other staff at the Globe, are really trying to pitch in and do what they can. And I hate to say this is a good thing in some ways, but it has really in some ways brought the newsroom together a bit, because everybody is bonding over the fact that, you know, they're dropping off single papers to people in Fitchburg and Linfield and Bridgewater and Cambridge.
Feeling the regular carrier's pain, I have to say.
Absolutely.
We'll come back to that in a second. But Tom, let me just turn to you briefly. Are you feeling the frustration too as a subscriber?
So, first of all, I think it proves that just because you can make money in commodities training doesn't mean you can run a newspaper. I didn't get the Globe from the 28th of December all the way through today. Was the first time I got it. But the thing
on
I
time?
On time. But the thing I think about is that really, while everyone got very angry about it, and certainly from the Globe's point of view, it was a financial disaster because money is still made out of paper. The reality is, suppose this has happened 25 years ago when people really depended upon the newspaper, mm-hmm. and that essentially was the source of news that was out there. Now, almost all of us turned to something else. So I didn't get the Globe for the last week and a half, but I still come here knowing what went on for the entire week because I read it online.
Yeah.
And I think to a degree, this really may be one of these things that starts to accelerate the shift of eyeballs away from newspaper and onto screens.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I hope you're not right.
Well, on that note, let's just play a little bit of tape here because, part of the discussion has been, you know, the death of print, rise of digital. And
yeah.
We talked to WBUR senior analyst John Carroll about it, and he said, that day is probably coming, but as of today, print subscriptions for papers like The Globe still really matter, and here's why.
The importance of home delivery is it's a built-in source of revenue so that you don't have to rely on newsstand sales every day. You basically have this base of revenue that you can rely on for whatever it is, 3 months, 6 months, whatever it might be.
And again, that's for now until someone truly figures out how to monetize digital. So, Shira, let me turn to you. I mean, I have to say one of the things that really kind of blew my mind about this is that back in the day, I mean, I was joking, but not really joking about paper boys and paper girls. Today, it's, you know, there are a lot of hardworking people who are your usual carriers, many of whom are immigrants. The newsroom at the Globe felt their pain this week. But also, there's the bigger business story. I mean, why is it that something which should be or seems to be as logistically straightforward as delivering a paper It's so hard.
Well, I think it, you know, there were a number of issues right on down the line, from the failure to hire enough drivers for the routes that were out there. They knew they were sort of, there were uncovered routes when they made the transition. There was also, I was told, a software program problem, which basically spat out routes that were done in alphabetical order. I know the route that I got in Back Bay in the South End was completely alphabetized. So what it meant was you were circling and circling and circling, sometimes six or seven times streets that you'd already been on, and that made everything take that much longer. So I think, you know, there was some kind of just really, for lack of a better way to say it, dumb mistakes made from the very start of this transition.
Okay,
but seriously, yeah. FedEx, United Parcel Service, the U.S. Post Office have kind of figured this whole thing out, and they have the software. Couldn't they even share it? I mean, isn't this even publicly available now?
I mean, that is a mystery to me as well. Why, you know, when you looked at these lists and you saw that they were alphabetical and, you know, you kind of threw up your hands and like, this makes no sense. And I think Kevin Cullen put it was like, you know, his route was like a drunk man with an Etch-a-Sketch. I mean, when you knew that this was happening, why? I mean, just that to start off with, it boggles my mind that that wasn't taken care of immediately. I mean, just simple Google Maps, you know, put in some data points and you can get a much better route out of that.
So what is this all say about how the Globe handled this vis-a-vis the PR and its relationship to its subscribers, I mean, the rest of us? Because I think a lot of people also felt kind of misled. They couldn't get anybody on the phone. You know, there was this long period of time before John Henry finally published an apology in the paper. A lot of people I know came away feeling like, okay, just admit there was a cost-cutting move. It didn't work. You guys were scrambling. But say something at least,
yeah,
Tom.
It was way too long to come clean on this one, and it's a classic PR fiasco. I'm sure that if you had, you know, PR experts out there, they tell you as soon as it happens, get in front of the story, you know, acknowledge it. And it is, you know, more than ironic that it is a media business that actually fails to do this.
The one that relies or demands transparency,
right,
from people.
Yeah, I would second that. I mean, just also the language that was used at the very start, delivery disruptions, delivery delays. I mean, this was a failure to deliver. This was non-delivery. And to keep sugarcoating it and sort of saying, you know, things that we're improving it, and nothing was changing was incredibly frustrated. I know that all of the reporters heard from subscribers personally, you know, about their, you know, frustration and this not getting resolved and the way the Globe was handling it. And also sort of the lack of reporting on the part of the Globe, the really in-depth reporting out of the story and checking when ACI, the media firm that was handling the delivery, said, oh, it's only 5% of customers that are affected. The number of complaints coming in
was
sort of
way more.
And those numbers, we should have known from the start, were not accurate numbers. And we should have been, as a paper, reporting it out much more thoroughly from the beginning and recognizing the colossal problem that it was.
Yeah, we certainly did see more aggressive reporting on FedEx's failure to deliver on Christmas than we saw about this.
You know, and also this town happens to be full of a lot of people in business schools who are experts in logistics and operations. I've taken classes from some of them. I'm sure they've got a lot of ideas on how to fix this problem. You know, the one takeaway, there's many, many takeaways from this Globe story, but one positive one I have to say that I felt is that, you know, in a way, in this crisis, we were reminded also about how much people still do love getting their Boston Globe in the morning and how much they still rely on it and how important it is. And so, is that a silver lining?
It is a silver lining.
I don't know. I think that actually one of the things at play here is that the demographics of the people who subscribed are really not the demographics that the Globe in the future wants. The demographics of those who subscribe tend to be very older, probably, you know, middle age, even senior citizens, and they're not the young people. Young people certainly aren't subscribing. And I wonder if it's almost, even though the money is still from the print advertising, I do wonder if perhaps they're sort of being overlooked because people so much want the younger reader.
I'm not so sure about that. And I'll just say that from the feedback I was getting, I live in a somewhat young neighborhood near one of the local universities, and I was getting a lot of complaints from neighbors, and they were not all older subscribers. So I would disagree with that. But I do think, you know, as you were saying before, there is a bit of a silver lining to see how much people care. And actually getting on, you know, I've gotten on the phone with subscribers who have said, you know, when my paper isn't there in the morning and I can't have my cup of coffee with my paper, my day is ruined.
Wow.
You know, on the other hand, it was also heartwarming to hear, you know, neighbors email me and say, you know, I just got my paper delivered along with the two or three or four others that I missed with a personal note from Farrah Stockman or with a personal note from Kevin Cullen. So, you know, it was nice to see that interaction as well between the readership and the writers.
I'm sure they would have actually rather been able to read the column itself.
Exactly.
In the paper,
exactly.
Okay.
I understand. But I mean, I think, you know, you're sort of lemonade out of lemons this point.
So Globe will stop beating up on you right now because we do need to turn to another media story that I mentioned at the very top of the show. And that is the fact that NBC this week announced or basically made it official that it's going to attempt to drop its ties or cut its ties with WHDH Channel 7, of course. Now, a lot of people who've been watching the television landscape in town for a while have said they're not surprised that this has happened. But on the other hand, you know, it still is significant news. NBC is now going to, as of January 2017, try to launch its own NBC-owned station for the Boston market, eighth largest market in the nation. So first of all, Tom, your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, while in some media, like print media, we see consolidation going on, the thing we are really seeing in electronic media, particularly TV, is the incredible fragmentation. It used to be that there were three major networks plus maybe the public network. And now we've got literally hundreds of networks. I was surprised to see that Anson, the owner of Channel 7, thinks that he can bring in the FCC and somehow get the FCC to say that this is a kind of a move of a monopolist. I don't think that's the case at all. I just don't think it's going to have all that much of an impact in terms of what we're watching.
Yeah,
I agree with Tom. I don't think it's going to have much of an impact because I know already I get half of my sort of visual news, so to speak, off my computer screen. And I think that's where a lot of people are going. And, you're already seeing a lot of people cutting the cord, as they say, with cable. And, ESPN, as we know, has suffered from that and had layoffs as a result of people cutting the cord. And I think, you know, 4, 5, 6 years from now, you're going to see an increasing number of people cutting the cord and going to their screens, you know, their iPads, their computers, wherever it may be, to get their local news reportage.
Right. I mean, the exception, Shira, as you well know, is sports.
Yes.
I mean,
right.
That is really live action is the one area where you want the immediacy of television. And, you know, NBC has Sunday Night Football. So people want to watch that. So, you know, what's going to happen if we don't get it? But aside from that, I mean, you go to Amazon, you go to Netflix, you do streaming, you watch all of the shows at one fell swoop. People just are not turning on the regular networks anymore.
Yeah. Well, I can hear some people out there. I imagine I hear them out there saying, hey, media type, stop your navel gazing. Move on to the other week's news. So let's do
that.
Was
there anything else?
Well, some pretty significant stuff, in fact, Tom, as you know. And let's turn to President Obama's executive actions on gun violence this week. He made some announcements which include trying to expand background checks and expanding gun sellers who have to have licenses and calls for smart gun technology. He gave a very emotional press conference this week, summed up in this moment here.
Our unalienable right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, those rights were stripped from college kids in Blacksburg and Santa Barbara and from high schoolers at Columbine and from first graders in Newtown. First graders. And from every family who never imagined that their loved one would be taken from our lives by a bullet from a gun. Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad.
Shira, let's start with you.
Well, I mean, it's tough to hear and it's tough to keep hearing. And you wonder if now with these tougher background checks that Obama is proposing, if it's really going to make a difference. I'm somebody who believes that all of these policy proposals and policy changes and executive orders and all of that are good steps. But I believe that it's really going to take a cultural change. We have to do something. I'm not the first person to bring up this point. It's been talked about, I think, with every mass shooting. We have to culturally change the way this country thinks about guns and gun violence in much the same way that we change the way we think about drunk driving, in the same way that we think about smoking. I mean, I remember those smoking ads where you have the woman who has lost her voice box, or you have the 30-year-old who's on oxygen. We have to get graphic. And I was listening to an interview, I think it was the other day, by former Attorney General Eric Holder, who was talking about the images of those first graders seeing the carnage, seeing the blood-spattered walls alongside children's drawings with their names written on those drawings, where, you know, as first graders do, they transpose the letters. So you saw the youth and the innocence with all of that carnage. And, you know, he was saying, if people saw those images, that's when they would change their thinking. So all of this is good and positive steps, and I'm glad that Obama's taking action. But I also think we need something more, perhaps something more graphic to create that cultural change.
Let's just say, though, in addition, that the president acknowledged that none of these executive actions would have actually stopped those mass shootings because the guns were acquired legally.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But he did point out that he felt like some kind of action might begin to do, in a way, what you were saying, Shira, that he believed that it could start, tackling the edges of this problem. But go ahead, Tom.
So I think what he's doing here is not believing that this executive order is going to change what happened. What he's doing is he's agenda setting. He is trying to bring the issue of guns in America to the top of the political agenda. And I think, and by the way, clearly he is deeply sincere in this. I think a number of Republicans stumbled very badly in their response when they started mocking his tears on this thing. And I think at the timing of what Obama is doing here is to raise this to the very top in terms of a presidential election, where you have the two Democratic candidates, or three Democratic candidates at this point, all of whom would clearly support his proposals and some significantly greater restrictions on guns versus the Republicans. There's clearly a political element here, but it's one that's going to, I think, resonate through the rest of this season.
You know what's interesting to me is that, in fact, when it comes to, for example, expanding background checks, we were looking at polling from November and December of just last year, and there is a great deal of support across the aisle amongst the American people for something like that. Even amongst Republicans, it was something, depending on how the question was asked, anywhere from 60 to 80%. But of course, all those voters aren't necessarily the ones that show up at the primary polls. But to bring it back home to Massachusetts, of course, in a way, it almost feels a little strange to have this conversation in a state like Massachusetts, where we do have already some of the strictest gun control laws in America.
But people are going to New Hampshire
to get their guns. Yeah. We're surrounded by states with varying degrees of gun regulation. But we talked to Mayor Marty Walsh about this, and he had this to say about the city's efforts to combat gun violence with us on Tuesday.
We had a 16-year low in homicides this year in the city of Boston, which were great police work, but we're also, our shootings are up a bit from last year. We took 800 guns off the street this year, 1,000 off the street last year, with the work of the men and women of the Boston Police Department. However, we still have more guns on the street.
And we also have, on the other side of that, we have some of the fewest gun deaths per capita in Massachusetts. But today, we had yet another shooting. A police officer got shot in Dorchester. So, how do we bring this problem or analysis of this problem back home to what we're facing here in Massachusetts, Shira? What's your thought on that?
Well, I think aren't there proposals out now that these are toy guns,
but have them specially marked.
One of the things that I always think about with this is technology. We live in this great technology hub in Boston. Why don't we start developing some gun technologies where only the shooter can fire the gun? I've seen it in James Bond movies, I'm sure.
Well, the smart gun technology the president wants, but no U.S. gun manufacturer will do it.
Well, this shows
something
how
like
the circular
this would actually go a
is.
Long way, because illegal guns that are out there have been stolen from someone.
Yes.
And if, in fact, you use the smart gun technology and mandated that technology, that over time would go a long ways towards reducing the illegal gun problem.
Yeah.
And at the same time, in theory, it satisfies the Second Amendment, folks, because it still means that the that people have been properly vetted can actually own a firearm.
Mm-hmm. You know, there also is still this idea that regardless of what we do today, the United States overall still has by far the highest number of guns per capita of any country in the entire world. So
cultural change. I mean, it seems like, I don't, to me at least, that's the bottom line. You know, you've got to change the way people think about guns, gun violence, and gun ownership. And until you get to that at the root of it, I think we're going to be continuing to have these debates. You're going to continue to have Republicans mock a president who cries about first graders being massacred. You know, and until you change the way people think about the issue.
Yeah. Well, yeah, in fact,
I would add the other piece that people have brought up, which I'm very sympathetic to, is the whole mental health piece. That what we are seeing, particularly with mass shootings, are people who are clearly deranged in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And we need that. Mental health is also one of the areas, as much as we make strides in healthcare, we don't think of mental health as a real healthcare issue. And we've really got to start thinking of it as one.
Right. And the executive action called for some $500 million to be put towards mental health, which is a start.
It's only a start.
It's a start.
I mean, all of this, honestly, is only a start. And the question is, you know, does it gain momentum? I mean, what happens with the you mentioned the presidential election earlier. What happens, you know, if there's a Republican president who comes in?
Mm-hmm. Where does the executive action will be undone. We can be sure of that.
Well, we've got just enough time to completely switch gears here and end on a note of a little levity, if at all possible, with our hubbubs. So who wants to start? Usually I make the assignment. Shira, you want to go? Okay, go.
Sure. I'm going to start with, on Thursday, this is a Mark Cuban story. On Thursday, billionaire entrepreneur and Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban announced that he had invested in a Beverly-based startup called Fantasy Labs. And the mission of Fantasy Labs is to provide, you know, fantasy sports players with the tools to pick better rosters and win more money. But it's more than about a billionaire investing in fantasy sports. It's about what it says at this time when there are all these regulations and fantasy sports is seen as gambling. He, I think, is a leading indicator that fantasy sports is here to stay and that they're going to get past these regulatory challenges. And this is going to be one of the big boom industries of the future.
So to pick better rosters and win more money, so to be more like that guy that the Globe featured, who like the number one most winningest.
Exactly. Where you're raking in millions upon millions of dollars at these fantasy sports games. That's your future, man.
Maybe. Well, maybe. Tom, you're up.
Well, I have another sports story, too. And this is, I think, the most extraordinary and outrageous sports story. In fact, maybe the biggest story of the season. And that is that Tom Brady was allegedly delivered human growth hormone, as you may have heard. He was delivered human growth hormone, accepted by his wife. Of course, the NFL immediately suspended Brady from play throughout the playoffs. There's talk that the Patriots will not be allowed to play. There's the FBI has opened an investigation, and two members of Congress.
Tom, I have to stop you right here.
What?
It's not Tom Brady. It's the Broncos quarterback, Peyton Manning.
Peyton Manning?
Yeah.
You mean Saint Peyton?
Yeah.
Oh, never mind.
Bravo! Saint Peyton. Right. Tell us how you really feel, Tom. All right. Well, today is a hat trick of sports hubbubs.
Oh, my gosh.
Because mine is also a sports hubbub, too.
I'm having some sort of influence here. Dangerous influence.
Mine is probably the most insignificant of all, though. That's because Wally has a new...
Oh. Yes.
I think I just got two completely different reactions. The Sox have a new mascot, Tessie.
Yes.
Tessie, Wally's little sister, who looks a lot like a super friendly pigtail. Are those pigtails I'm looking at? I can't tell. Red pigtails on top of a green monster wearing a Boston Red Sox shirt and a red skirt. So we know that that Major League Baseball has been trying to expand its appeal, maybe to more women, to younger folks. I don't know if this
pink
gets...
Pink hats and Tessie. You know?
If this gets the five-year-old like Sesame Street set excited, maybe that is the case. I don't know. But welcome, Tessie. That's my hubbub today. With that, let's wrap up. Not a moment too soon. Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Always great to have you. Happy
Likewise.
Weekend. And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor. Great to have you as well.
My
and
pleasure.
The Oscar goes to Tom Keene today, by the way. There's more of the show coming up in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.